Blog Talk Radio.
This is your host, Jamal Brown. You have tuned in to another exciting show of the Gist of Freedom Radio. I'd like to give a special shout-out, as I always do, to our lovely, fantastic, all-around good woman producer, Miss Leslie Gist, author and producer of this show. I am, as I always do, going to lead off with the Black Fact of the Day, the Black Fact of the Day. Today is the 146th year in which we have commemorated the celebration known as Juneteenth. Juneteenth, for those in the listening audience who may not know, is taught that it is the day that enslaved Africans, oftentimes called slaves, but we'll say enslaved Africans, who lived in the state of Texas, found out that legal enslavement was over. For those of you who maybe going back in your mind about fifth grade history, you know that the Emancipation Proclamation, let me slow down a bit, Emancipation Proclamation supposedly ended legal enslavement. However, word did not get to Galveston, Texas until this day, June 19th, 1865. Again, this is the 146th year in which we acknowledge that day. We have on the line with us a gentleman who is a scholar and an author who's wrote a fantastic book for teens, and it's called Monster. The gentleman I'm speaking of is none other than Mr. Walter Dean Myers. Mr. Dean Myers, are you on the line with us?
Yes, I am.
Fantastic, fantastic. How are you doing this day?
I'm good.
Good, good, good. I like to always start off by asking one simple question. Sometimes it takes people aback, but hopefully I'm sure you'll ace it. The question simply being, let us in the listening audience know, who is Mr. Walter Myers?
Well, I'm an author. I was raised in Harlem, high school dropout, and I've published 102 books.
Wow.
Right. And I now I've published about 5 books this year. I work with my sons at times, Christopher Myers, award-winning artist, and that's who I am. I write about things that concern me. I'm also a collector. I collect African-American photographs from 1850 until 1940. I have a collection of some 10,000 photographs. So I'm trying to put the history together as far and also deal with the issues that are facing young African-Americans, especially young African-American males, primarily because that's my own background.
Certainly. Certainly. 102 books. We'll get into some of those in a bit, but let's talk about this book, Monster. Tell us, I read some of the reviews. Some of them make it seem like it's one of the best books ever. So I want to hear a little bit about that one. What inspired you to write about it? And just give us a brief summary on what it's about.
Well, I visit juvenile detention facilities a lot. I go to these places and I talk to young people who are incarcerated, and these kids are between the ages of 10 and 17. 10 sounds very young, but you have 10-year-olds in these institutions. One of the things that I saw was that many of the young people were making on-the-spot decisions about their actions. And I know this is wrong. Most people who are successful have a warning. I mean, you learn how to deal with things around the kitchen table. You listen to your parents talking, and you listen to your grandparents and uncles and aunts, and they give you a clue as to what to look out for. But many of the young people today don't have those dinner table conversations. They don't have that. So I decided to write a book which poses some questions. What do you do when you're faced with the idea of perhaps doing a crime or something that might be a crime? And Monster is about a young man who's asked to be a lookout, not to go into a store and to do anything wrong, but to do a lookout, to be a lookout. And he goes in, and because he doesn't do anything, he thinks that he's not responsible for any of the crimes that were committed, and he is later arrested and put on trial. And this is the story of his Monster is the story of his trial. What I hope to get from the book is to get young people not to have answers, but to do the thinking, to think about what they're doing, to consider the possibilities of being in trouble before it actually happens. And this is what I want with all my books, really. Not to give kids answers, because we do that too much. But I have faith in the young people. What they can do is they can figure it out for themselves, given the opportunity.
Certainly, certainly. And now this is a factual book, am I correct?
No, it's done in a fictional way. It's a made up story, but one that mirrors the many stories I've heard in prisons. I've been in prisons from every place, from California through up in New York State, and talking to young people and seeing the kinds of trouble, because now, we're sending so many of these kids into the juvenile justice system. It's frightening. I was at a meeting of 100 black men, and I was talking to someone, and they had no idea that there were even juvenile jails in this country. But we incarcerate just so many hundreds and hundreds of kids every year, and once they're incarcerated, we teach them self-medication. You know, one of the worst things to see is a line up of kids in the morning being medicated. They take, and then when they come out of jail, and they self-medicate themselves on the street,
right.
we arrest them again.
Right. We illicit drugs or so, you know.
Exactly.
As if the other ones weren't illicit enough.
Exactly. Precisely.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Let me read for the audience a few of these reviews. We have words like chilling and engrossing. Another one here says, the sheer authenticity of the novel and its presentation are disquieting and totally riveting. These are some very powerful words. Let me ask you this. The title, Monster, how did that come about?
During the course of the trial, the prosecutor begins to refer to the people who committed the crime as monsters. And this is very deliberate because they want to dehumanize these people.
Dehumanize, right.
And he writes that down on his notebook, and his defense attorney crosses it out and tells him, you're not a monster.
Mm. Wow. One thought that comes to mind as you say that is the Central Park joggers. There was, some brothers who were accused of that, and Donald Trump and others consistently refer to them as a wolf pack. Again,
right.
taking away the human element. You know, it's easy for a wolf pack to act ferocious and be mean, and, you know, that paints a definite picture in people's minds, a picture that's scary. And, again, you don't have any problem with doing away with wolf pack, but doing away with the person. You know, and the end result was all these brothers were innocent, by the way, you know, but that process of dehumanization definitely it took place and occurred inside the minds of many, many people.
Exactly.
That is something. Let me ask you, why is it that you choose to write books or this particular book for young people? And of your 102 books that you've published,
I started writing for these teenagers, and then eventually I began to build a career. And then eventually I saw myself making lots of doing very well, you know, and I've done 102 books. When my son came along, one of my sons is a retired chaplain from the Air Force, and the other one is a writer and illustrator. So I could keep him busy.
Right. That's awesome. Now we've heard the reviews from the so-called professionals who review books. Tell me some of the reviews that you've heard, the stories, the testimonies from the young people, perhaps even their parents or guardians or what have you. But the young people is really I want to hear the stories that they've shared with you about how they've accepted your book, how it spoke to them.
And they write to me and they say that they recognize themselves in the books. And
mm-hmm.
one of the things that we really need to do is to put real life into the books.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what they say. They say, I recognize myself. This is, you know, this is, these kids are like me. And, you know, I'm glad that someone there understands what I'm going through.
Mm-hmm.
Three books, as Leslie does, but not many people doing it. Not many people are willing to do the hard research necessary.
Right. As you're talking, I can't help but think of a video clip I came across earlier this week. I believe it was from 2009, but it was of Democracy Now! Was Amy Goodman talking with some young people who had been sentenced to a long over...
saving money by turning the prisons over to private concerns. But then there's a incentive for the private concerns to lobby for more prisoners. And so it's a constant feeding thing. But, you know, there's something else that's going on. You know, we see the prisoners when they go on trial. But the real story is before they go on trial. Now, so you get as many white kids as black kids. You get more white kids than black kids committing crimes, but in that process leading up to the actual trial, these white kids get a second chance, a third chance. They get referred to agencies, and our kids don't.
Mm-hmm.
And I just interviewed a kid up in the Bronx a few months ago. I had a really devastating day. This kid was in jail for jumping over a turnstile in the subway. I said, "Oh, Jesus!" You know, I mean, it was just unbelievable. I just watched a documentary by Frederick Wiseman called Juvenile Court, and that was in Tennessee. And you see,
disturbing to say the least. Our show's producer, Ms. Leslie, she wrote about the first HBCU in New Jersey, the Bordentown School, which many consider to be the Tuskegee of the North. It was actually closed down as a result of a Brown versus the Board of Education. Now it is a juvenile detention center there in New Jersey. And she wanted me to let you know that she's extending the invitation for you to come out to their annual commemoration next month and speak and sign books and sell books and all that good stuff. So I wanted to pass along that message to you.
Well, it's, you know, you have these places all over the city, all over the country, and they closed Spofford up in the Bronx, and they're closing places to save money. But what that really amounts to is that the whole eighth agent has to read. Every kid who goes to the eighth grade has to read Monster. And
wow!
It's mandatory.
Now, did you have to lobby for that, or just it was just received by some higher ups and they made it happen?
They made it happen.
Awesome.
You know, they made it happen, and it's mandatory reading in many places around the country. It was made into a play.
Also, what's next on the table for you?
Well, after 9/11, there was this collective grief, and then there was anger, and then there was this spate of patriotism.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that I was part of the grief, I was part of the anger, but somehow, when people started talking about patriots, it didn't include me.
That skipped you, huh?
They skipped me. I said, "Whoa, wait a minute now. What's going on here?" And I see that in many, many instances wherein when they talk about the real America, they're not talking about people who look like me. I just interviewed an 84-year-old guy from... who was in the Red Ball Express in World War II, and the Red Ball Express were the suppliers, supply line for the invading troops to liberate Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And he was that whenever he hears about the longest day and all this stuff, they never include Black Americans. So I decided to do a book called We Are America. And including all Americans, Native Americans, Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans, and my son did the illustrations. And what this is a book which is inclusive. You know, from my point of view, we African Americans fought in the Revolutionary War.
Mm-hmm. Every single one. War of 1812, all of them.
Four races of all of them, you know, and how can people look at us and say, "Oh, well, you're not the real Americans." We are the real Americans. We are the real Americans, and you know.
Right, South Bronx, huh?
right. And then I did a. I'm thinking of doing a Madame Butterfly, an all-black Madame Butterfly next. You know. I'm doing book on World War II. I'm doing, you know, I did a book with William Miles. I'm sure you saw this book of the Black 369, the Black soldiers in World War One. The people, when I was working on that book, and I would go looking for photographs, and people told me, "Oh, there were no soldiers, Black soldiers in World War One." I said, "You got to be kidding me!"
Excuse me, right?
Excuse me. I did. I told you I'm a collector. Also, I did a an exhibit at the Anacostia about Black aviators in the 30s. The Black aviators in the 30s were before the Tuskegee people, and you know they. And I came across that story by accident. I was in a shop in Harlem looking to buy pictures and old photographs, and I buy thousands of dollars worth of old photographs. So what happened, a guy came up to me and said, "Oh, you're buying old photographs. Are you interested in the Italian-Ethiopian War?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Yeah, agency. I have a website, walterdmeyers.net, and I'd love to hear from you."
Got it, got it. Walter Dean Myers, W-A-L-T-E-R, Dean, D-E-A-N, Myers, M-Y-E-R-S.
That's correct.
.net.
Yes.
Fantastic, fantastic. Any closing thoughts you'd like to share with the audience?
Well, you know, keep on writing and keep on reading.
Simple as that. Simple yet profound. I appreciate our time, Mr. Myers. I hope that one day our paths connect in person, and I'll actually be going out and see if I can pick up one of those books, see if I can pick up Monster here shortly. I do some mentoring on a weekly basis with some young men who've had some troubled paths, and I'm certain from what you're telling me that it will be right up their alley.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
All right. I'd like to say thank you again to our listening audience. It's been a pleasure. We'll be back at you on Thursday. Have a good night. Bye now.
But if we are wise